I'm sorry about. But anyway, you should feel free to call me Latham. So, by way of introduction, also you should feel free to speak up and ask questions, or if you have questions afterwards, come up and talk to me, I hope. Or come by my office, or if I'm not in my office, email me to set up a time to come by my office. I don't have any particular office hours or anything like that, I don't know. So, by way of introduction, I just wanted to say cosmology is everything. All the other courses you've taken are like eensy weensy little bugs that are all like little flecks of dirt on the gigantic body of cosmology. It's like the dominant course. Everything else is a little exercise you do to learn more about cosmology. But it is true that it is like the broadest discipline of human knowledge. It's supposed to be about the universe as a whole. And we have 15 lectures to supposedly cover all of it. So that means we're really going to try to just hit the highlights. The plan is to have every lecture be really a highlight and more or less hopefully stand on its own. So probably more than in other courses, the various lectures will be rather independent of one another. If you miss a lecture or don't understand a particular lecture, it's probably pretty likely that the next lecture will in some sense start fresh if you want. So, which is not to say you should miss lectures or have your goal be to not understand them, but probably more than in most classes, it has this sort of structure. I guess except for in the first week. The first week is a little bit different in that regard, and so let me just try to summarize what I'm planning to do. Basically, these first two lectures, lectures one and two, are going to be a kind of succinct review of differential geometry and general relativity. And I know that'll be a review for some of you who have just taken Ruth's course. So I ask you to bear with me. I just want to make sure everybody's on the same page. And these things are so central to everything you're going to do in the rest of your physics career that it probably doesn't hurt to see them all succinctly summarized one more time from a different perspective, hopefully, than you've heard before. But the idea is that the first week of the class is basically pure geometry, okay? The idea is to start generally and then sort of zoom in lectures three and four on the most important Riemannian spaces and Lorentzian spacetimes that appear in physics, the maximally symmetric spaces like anti-de Sitter space, de Sitter space, Minkowski space, the Friedman, Robertson, Walker metrics. Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes, these are the ones that apparently observationally describe the universe we live in. And then the black hole metrics. Okay, basically we just want to understand simply what all of these spaces are, understand in a simple way how they are actually very simply related to one another. Just to put in context the actual guy that describes the large-scale structure of our universe somehow situate it within the menagerie here. And then the idea is to really get to know the FRW spacetime geometrically in lecture five. So how do particles behave in this spacetime? What is its horizon structure like? How does the evolution of the spacetime respond to the presence of matter that's in it? How does the matter that's in it respond to the evolution of the spacetime? So in some sense, if you will, that's all. The first week is as I say, just geometry. The second week, I'll be a little bit more sketchy at the moment about the exact outline. But the idea is that cosmology lets us look at beyond the standard model physics in basically two different ways. Okay, you know, one thing is you get to probe the universe on gigantic scales today, where gravity is really dominant, whereas on small terrestrial scales in laboratories on the Earth, you don't have that opportunity, and so you see new things, and we do see new things that we don't understand that clearly are telling us something about physics beyond the standard model: dark matter, dark energy, things about the large scale structure of the universe that we don't have the answer for why they are the way they are. And then the other thing is that the early universe, okay, so just the fact that it's huge will let us see new things like dark matter and dark energy, and we want to get a sense of what we know and don't know about these apparent mysteries that are being presented to us. And then also the early universe was tremendously hot and dense. It apparently reached densities and temperatures and energy scales that are way above what we can reach with accelerators on the Earth. And so again, this is another thing where we expect there to be relics from this early period of extraordinarily high energies that will give us hints about very high energy physics. And indeed, we think that probably the dark matter that we observe in the universe today, the asymmetry between matter and antimatter that we observe in the universe today, possibly dark energy, possibly a few other things that we observe about the universe that we live in are giving us clues that we would like to, in this class, we would like to at least summarize what the clues are, what we really do and don't know about them, because it's some of the most important stuff that remains to be solved in cosmology. Okay, so the second week is, if you want, about the hints that are provided about physics beyond the standard model, what we do and don't know about them. As part of this, we are going to want to understand the two most important observational clues we have about the early universe. And so that is the what cosmologists usually call Big Bang nucleosynthesis. That is to say, we observe the abundance of light elements in the periodic table in the universe today, and we understand how those light elements, how those abundances were created. They were created in the early universe, and so we want to understand that, because that provides one of our key constraints. That's the main reason that we think we understand what the universe was like only 1 second or 1 minute after the Big Bang. And then the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so the cosmic microwave background, in brief, is a snapshot that the universe took of itself when it was orders of magnitude younger than it is today. So it went through a transition where it released photons that have subsequently just streamed through the universe. So they give us essentially a perfect photograph of what the universe was like at that time. And so, again, observations of the cosmic microwave background today and its properties give us our most detailed information about the early universe, our most detailed confirmation that we know what we're talking about in modeling the early universe, and also may be the best place to look for clues, again, for beyond the standard model physics in cosmology. Okay, and then week three. Week three, the idea is that there the idea is to focus on. Let's do week three. The idea is to focus on quantum fields in curved space-time. Okay. The idea being that, uh, so For example, when we look at the cosmic microwave background, it has all sorts of detailed statistical properties that we observe. We very cleanly measure them. And then it's the job of the cosmologist to explain where those properties are coming from. At the moment, the best models, the models that do the best job of explaining this information, have this quality. The basic idea is that there are some fields in space-time that started off in their vacuum state in the early universe, and then it was the expansion of the universe itself that drove the fields out of their vacuum, that created or amplified the fluctuations, the zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum, into the primordial perturbations that ultimately condensed over the subsequent history of the universe into stars and galaxies and you and me, especially me. So as a lead up to this, we'll have to learn about we'll probably learn about the Unruh effect, which is sort of the simplest and the fundamental road into this topic. It's at the basis of understanding production of perturbations in the early universe and also the evaporation of black holes. So that'll be a good thing to learn about in general. Have other classes covered the Unruh effect? Has anyone else talked about that? Okay, in that case, it would be a travesty. Even though that's not strictly speaking cosmology, it would be a travesty to leave the program without learning about the Unruh effect. It's like, the Unruh effect is this effect that, it's this effect that an accelerated observer, let's say this is Minkowski space, it's in the vacuum, there's no particles, and then I turn on my rocket and I begin accelerating through Minkowski space, then suddenly I'm like, whoa, what happened? Suddenly it looks like instead of being the vacuum, the universe is full of a thermal bath of particles, and as I turn up my rocket and accelerate faster and faster, I observe that the temperature of that thermal bath goes up and up in proportion to my acceleration. Okay, anyway, it's awesome. But that makes it sound not connected to anything, whereas in fact the idea is that it's connected to everything. That's too much of a tangent about the Unruh effect. Okay, but in brief, that's the idea of week three. We'll be talking about quantum fields and the weird things that happen when you put them in. You have them live on a background space-time that can be curved, or even if it's flat, like in the Unruh effect, ultimately has to obey the principle of general relativity, that you can describe it, that you're equally allowed to describe it in different reference frames with different coordinates and different observers. Okay. So that, in brief, is the outline. That's what I was hoping to cover. There really is a ton of great stuff in there. Some of it, you're going to see. Some of it, we're only going to have like an hour to talk about it, and you're going to be crushed at the end that we don't have more time to talk about it because it is so awesome. But then you're going to all become cosmologists. You'll have the rest of your lives to do it. So it'll be okay. Okay, so. No. Okay, before plunging in, I usually like to tell a joke at the beginning. Now, I don't know if you guys, maybe it won't even be necessary this year. Are any of you guys taking the previous class? Are any of you taking quantum information? So some of you are, yeah. I mean, like last year, this was really essential because all the students were like taking all three classes that term, and so they were completely zoned out by the time I began, and I had to do something. But anyway, so I usually tell a joke. It's not a funny joke. Instead, my wife's father. My wife is from Odessa, in the former Soviet Union, on the Black Sea, and her father is a huge compendium of jokes from Odessa. And the main thing to say about these jokes is that for the first, let's say, 10 years that I was together with my wife, I thought they were not funny. But then they worked their way inside me, and now I think they are funny. But you will not think they're funny, but they'll still wake you up a little bit. So anyway, so to give you a taste, Misha gets on the train to Petersburg, and he sits down across from a man wearing a nice suit with a briefcase next to him, and they sit there, and the man opens his briefcase and puts it on his lap and takes out a banana and a salt shaker. He peels the banana and he shakes some salt on it, and then he throws it out the window. And okay, so a few minutes later, he does the same thing again, and Misha says, you know, what are you doing? And the man says, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry. I didn't even think to ask you if you wanted them. For my part, I don't like salty bananas. See? That's the whole joke. Humans can change. Just let that marinate and come back to it in a few years. You'll feel differently about it. So now let me get down to business. So as I say, this lecture and the next one are about just a lightning review of differential geometry and general relativity. Again, my apologies to those of you who have already, who will find a lot of this to be review. I hope some of it will be new for everyone. And again, it's good to see these things can, they take a long time to learn the first time around, but it's nice to see that after the fact that they can be kind of more or less summarized in about an hour. So I think I'll only have time to do differential geometry today, and then we'll do GR tomorrow, and then possibly by the end of tomorrow's lecture have a chance to move on to discussing these various spacetimes. But okay, so differential geometry. So the main point that I want to get across is just the conceptual structure, and that it comes in three stages. I think it's good to try to get a sense of which aspects of geometry, of differential geometry, Riemannian geometry, come first, and which ones only come when you add additional structure to the theory. So first, we just want to start off with a manifold, no connection yet. No notion of covariant derivative, no metric. And we want to know when we just have a manifold, what do we have? That's stage one. Then we want to add a connection on the manifold. So that's stage two. And we want to ask what additional concepts become available once we've introduced this thing called a connection on the manifold. And then finally, stage three, we want to also add a metric. Okay. And again, we want to see what additional concepts become available, what new structures come into play. When the geometry has both a connection and a metric. Okay, so let's start with a manifold. So first of all, what is a manifold? Well, as far as a physicist is concerned, a manifold is just an n-dimensional manifold. It's just something that if you zoom in close enough on any point, it looks just like a little bit of n-dimensional Euclidean space. Okay, so. So a two-sphere, and a two-torus are both two-dimensional manifolds, even though they have different topology, because if I zoom in close enough on either of these guys, I can't tell the difference between either of these little patches and a little patch of the two-dimensional Euclidean plane. Okay, and now a key thing about a manifold is that it doesn't have any intrinsic way that it should have coordinates laid down in it. The manifold by itself offers you no clues about which way to put coordinates down on it. And so you should be free to put down coordinates whichever way you want. You can put down these coordinates, or you can put down some different set of coordinates. It shouldn't matter. There are intrinsic geometric things about the intrinsic geometric objects that can live on the manifold, and the idea at each stage here is to preserve the fact that that you're describing those intrinsic things in a way that that it doesn't matter that you in order to describe them properly, you don't need to choose some particular coordinate system. You can choose any coordinate system you want. Okay, so in particular, in doing that, an important sort of object will be a tensor, a tensor of rank mn. So this is some object. It can have indices. It can have any number of up indices. Let's say it has m. And any number of down indices. Let's say it has n. So we call that a tensor of rank m, n. And these are called contravariant indices. These are called covariant indices. And if you want, one can say more conceptually what a tensor is. But if you want, at the practical level, a tensor is an object that just like a vector, you know, just like the gravitational field is some intrinsic vector. I imagine it, you know, sitting at this point in space and pointing down. But its components will depend on whether I choose my coordinate system to be this, you know, oriented like this or oriented like this. It'll be the same vector, but just have different components. You can think of these guys as similarly the components of this tensor, but the actual values of the individual components will get mixed up depending on which coordinate system I choose to slice up my manifold. And the rule, the thing that makes it a tensor, is that when I change from one coordinate system, let's say the x mu coordinate system, to a different coordinate system, let's say the x twiddle mu coordinate system, that the components of the tensor in the new coordinate system, in the twiddle coordinate system, have to be related to the components in the old coordinate system. By the so-called tensor transformation law, where basically for each pair of indices here, I need a transformation for each index here and its corresponding index in the old frame. I need a corresponding transformation matrix of the following form. Okay, and so on, and then I have a transformation matrix for each of these guys up to this pair. And similarly, these are just dots here. And similarly for the lower indices, except the matrices that transform the lower indices are the inverse of these matrices. So instead of having an x twiddle on top and an x on the bottom, like these transformation matrices do, when I want to transform this index to this index, I need to use the inverse guy. Okay, so x twiddles on the bottom here, x twiddles on the top over here. Okay, and so in some sense, these if you take the particular case of a rank 1-0 tensor, that in other words, a guy that just has one index and it's up, that's a so-called contravariant vector. And if you take the particular case of a 0-1 tensor with just one index, which is down. That's a so-called covariant vector. And the idea is that these guys have simple meaning. And for these simple vector quantities, there are two different sorts of natural intrinsic vectors that can lie on the manifold. So this guy, So first of all, what is the contravariant vector? Well, the contravariant vector. A contravariant vector you can think of as representing a directional derivative. So let's say I want to take the derivative. Okay, I could take the derivative in the. I could take the partial derivative in the x mu direction. Oh, by the way, a bit of notation. The partial derivative d dx mu, I will also sometimes write that as just. D mu. Have previous people used that notation? And then when I take the partial derivative of some object, let's say a vector alpha, sometimes instead of writing partial sub m, I'll write v alpha, comma mu. Okay. And similarly for covariant derivatives, which we'll get to in a moment. While I'm saying notation, let me mention it now. Covariant derivatives I'll write this way. And when I have the covariant derivative of some object, another common notation for that is to use a semicolon to show that you're taking a covariant derivative with respect to that index. Okay, so now back to my partial derivatives here. So I can take a partial derivative. I could take it in the d mu direction, or I could take it in the d nu direction, or I could take it in some arbitrary linear combination of directions. So an arbitrary linear combination of partial derivatives, an arbitrary directional derivative, is some vector of coefficients contracted with d mu. Oh. And another bit of notation, which I imagine you've all encountered in your previous GR course, I'll follow this Einstein summation convention, where whenever I have two indices that are the same, one up and one down, they're summed over. So this means v0 ddx0 plus etc. summed up over the number of dimensions of the manifold. That notation everyone's seen? Everyone's happy with? Yeah. But the idea is that, intrinsically I'm taking the directional derivative along this direction. It shouldn't matter. That directional derivative has a meaning along that direction regardless of what coordinates I describe it in. So if I had instead described it in the Twiddled coordinates, I would write it like this. Okay, but then just using the chain rule from multivariable calculus, I can just rewrite this expression so that it looks like I can just rewrite this derivative as like that. And so now, okay, and then this is a dummy index. Let me just change this to a new so I can compare it more easily to this expression, because I have a new on this guy. I want a new here also. So comparing these two expressions, I see that the coefficient here had better be equal to the coefficient here, because now they're both expressed in the same basis. They're both coefficients multiplying the same basis vectors, namely d Twiddle nu. So I see that the coefficients expressed in the Twiddle basis are related to the coefficients in the untwiddled basis in this way. Okay, and so in other words, this is exactly the tensor transformation law for a rank 1, 0, a contravariant vector. It's exactly this transformation law in the case with one index up and no indices down. Okay, and so that is exactly what you should think of a contravariant vector as being. They are the components of a more intrinsic object, namely a directional derivative in some direction, along some direction at the point P. And Vm or Vtwiddlem just are the components of that directional derivative expressed with respect to the normal or the twiddled coordinate basis, respectively. And similarly, a 0-1 object, that's another sort of directional object you can have on the manifold. So at some point here, I can imagine taking a little step. Okay, I can take a step purely in the dx mu direction, in the dx mu coordinate direction, or I could take a step in the dx nu coordinate direction, or more generally, I can take an infinitesimal step in some arbitrary direction, which is some arbitrary linear combination of the dx mu's. And again, I've expressed it in the x coordinates, but it's supposed to be some intrinsic step that I took along the manifold from the point p to the point p to the infinitesimally nearby point p prime. So I should be able to express the same thing in any coordinate system I choose. So I express it again in the V-twiddle coordinate system. It looks something like this. And then now if I just do the same thing, I take dx mu, and I, again, just use the chain rule to write it as dx mu as partial x mu, partial x-twiddle nu, dx-twiddle nu. And now again, I have to switch mu. I have to switch the label mu to nu here. Comparison. Okay, so now these two expressions, I have a coefficient times a basis vector, and a set of coefficients multiplying the same set of basis vectors, and these two things have to be equal. So I find the transformation law that v twiddle nu is equal to okay, and of course this is nothing but the transformation law for a 0-1 covariant vector. And so again, this is what you should think of a 0-1 covariant vector being. It's an infinitesimal, colloquially it's an infinitesimal displacement on the manifold, and V, or a 1 form that lives at this point. V mu and V nu twiddle are the components of that one form expressed either in the basis, the x mu coordinate basis or the x twiddle coordinate basis. Okay, and a more general tensor just represents, we end up having to introduce more general tensors because along the way we'll find that more and more we want to consider objects that behave not like an individual vector or contravariant vector or covariant vector, but some tensor product of m contravariant and n covariant vectors. And so they end up having to transform exactly like that tensor product would. Okay, so that's maybe enough about step one. When you have a manifold, you have tensors, but one of the things we don't yet know is how to relate. We don't really have any. So there's a vector space that kind of lives over this point on the manifold, and you can have contravariant vectors and covariant vectors or tensors that represent tensor products of vectors drawn from that vector space. But we don't yet have any way of relating the vectors that live in the vector space over this point in the manifold to the vectors that live in the vector space over this point in the manifold. Like if you wanted to ask, you know, is this vector parallel to this vector? At the moment, we don't have any structure that would allow you to answer that question. We don't know the lengths of the vectors. We don't know the dot products. We don't know how to take angles between vectors. Okay, so with that in mind, time to move on to step two, adding the connection to the manifold. I keep trying to make it a... You know, the screen isn't showing me anything, so I keep trying to make it come alive. but in the process, oh well. Okay, so what do we get when we add a connection? Well, the motivating point is that if we start with a tensor, like let's take again the case of just a simple contravariant vector, and now we take its derivative. I mean, it's going to routinely be the case in physics that we have to take objects and then take their derivatives. We want to construct momenta or velocity. The problem is that if we just take the partial derivative of a tensor, we want this resulting thing. This resulting thing has a new index. So it was originally a rank 1-0 tensor, and now we've added another index. So we want it to be a rank 1-1 tensor now. But it doesn't transform like a rank 1-1 tensor. I mean, to see that, imagine we took this in the twiddled frame and asked how it was related to the untwiddled quantity. Well, by the chain rule, this guy is nothing but and because this guy, by assumption, is a tensor, it is nothing but okay, and now the point is that this, when this partial derivative acts on this product of two factors, it acts according to the Leibniz rule, and it produces two terms. The first term, when this guy just passes through this factor and acts on that and takes the derivative of this factor, that gives us exactly the term we want. But, okay, so if that was all there was, then that would be, that's exactly the expected tensor transformation law from a 1-1 object to a 1-1 object. But there's another term, because we also get the term where the d alpha acts on this prefactor here. And that spoils the tensorial nature. Okay, and so just to review, as you've probably met in your previous GR courses, so we need to do something about this. We need to get rid of that guy. And so the solution is to introduce a new derivative, covariant derivative, which is a combination of the partial derivative and an additional piece and the idea now is that if we want this combined object to transform like a tensor, we can derive how this object gamma mu nu alpha has to transform. And this is something that you'll review in the tutorial today if you haven't, if you're not familiar with it already. But so you'll see that the way that this guy has to transform is, again, not as a tensor, because it has to, this thing was already behaving not as a tensor. And so to fix the problem, this guy has to similarly behave not as a tensor. It has to have an analogous extra term with the opposite sign to cancel off the extra term that came from the transformation of this guy, non-tensorial term. And so the transformation law is that, well, it has two terms analogous to this. The first term is just the ordinary expected tensor transformation law for such an object. plus an extra piece. Oh, there is one other important thing that I forgot to mention at the beginning of the class, it occurs to me. So, because my handwriting is bad, and I make mistakes on the blackboard, I write up quite detailed notes for every lecture, and the notes for lectures 1 and 2 are on the wiki. I should have mentioned that right at the beginning. Sorry about that. I'll be posting all of the notes prior to the... prior to the classes. So yeah, so sorry, you don't actually have to worry about copying the stuff down. Sorry for not mentioning that earlier. Okay, and then it turns out there's an exactly equivalent, alternative form to write this where you have the same initial term and so in any case, the idea is that we introduce this new field with three indices on the manifold, and the only thing at the moment it can be arbitrary, it can be anything we want. The only requirement that we place on this guy, sometimes this guy is called the connection. Sometimes people refer to the covariant derivative based on that connection as the connection. I'll probably oscillate between using those two terms. But we introduce this connection field on the manifold. The only requirement at the moment is that under a coordinate transformation, it transform in this non-tensorial way. And the point is that once we impose that requirement, that... that we can take the covariant derivative of any tensor object of rank m, n. We take it by, you've probably seen this transformation law before, but just to review, the covariant derivative with that connection acting on any tensor of arbitrary rank is obtained by, first we just have a partial derivative term, the ordinary partial derivative term. And then for every up index, we get an additional term that comes in with a plus sign that has the derivative index, the index that we're differentiating, the index that we're acting on, and another dummy index, gamma, to replace it. So we get m terms with plus signs that all have this same structure, except a dummy index gamma replaces one of these m indices in each guy, and then we get m terms here, and then correspondingly n terms with minus signs here. Where again the connection has the derivative index, the lower index that it's acting on, and a dummy index that replaces that index in the tensor. Okay, and so the idea is that with this transformation law, together with this rule for how to take a covariant derivative, that we've now succeeded in constructing a derivative operator that takes a rank m n tensor and converts it into a rank m n plus 1 tensor. Okay, so you can check that this guy does indeed transform tensorially. Under a change of coordinates. Okay? So, what is that good for? Well, for one thing, of course, when we get to physics, you know, the important thing about tensors is that you can if I have a tensor with a bunch of objects and I can track it, if I take a bunch of tensors and I can track them together in such a way that there's no hanging indices left over at the end, the tensorial transformation law guarantees that the resulting object is a scalar. And you know, the basic thing that I specify in building any physical theory is a scalar Lagrangian, which I integrate to obtain the action that defines the theory. And I want a simple way of writing down basically all of the, given a certain set of fields and basic objects, I want to be able to write down all combinations of those fields and derivatives of those fields that form scalars to build up my action. So it's crucial physics-wise from that standpoint. But just at the mathematical level, what new things become available to us once we have the connection? First of all, it gives us a natural notion of parallel transport. It gives us a natural connection between the vector spaces that live over the point A on the manifold and the point B on the manifold once I specify a curve, gamma, that connects the points A and B. Okay? So in other words, before I had these vectors that lived up here, lived over point A, and I had another vector space that lived over point B, and it had vectors in it, but I had no natural way of identifying the vectors in one space or the other. But now that I have the connection, if you give me the connection and you also give me a path gamma connecting A and B, well then, I can define the notion of vectors being parallel to one another all along this path by saying that, so I say that a tensor T alpha 1, alpha m, beta 1, beta n is, okay, so let gamma, let the path gamma be some curve x mu of tau. Tau is a parameter along the curve. And at some particular value of that parameter, x mu are the coordinates of the curve. Okay, so x mu of tau is the curve expressed in some coordinates. And u mu equals dx mu d tau is just the tangent vector to that curve. And so I say that if I have a value of this, if I have the components of this tensor everywhere along this curve, I say that the components of the tensor at each point along the curve are parallel to the ones everywhere else along the curve if the directional derivative of the tensor along that curve vanishes. Okay? So this is just saying, this is the general covariant derivative of that tensor. This particular linear combination where I can track delta mu with u mu, that's just saying take the directional derivative along the direction of the curve. And so this is the covariant statement that the tensor is not changing as I go along the curve. That the tensor remains parallel to itself as I go along the curve. Okay? So I get a notion of parallel transport. And as soon as I have a notion of parallel transport, I also get a natural special type of curve on the manifold, namely the geodesics. So the geodesics are the the geodesics are the special curves that parallel transport their own tangent vector. Okay, so now I take the directional derivative along the curve of the tangent vector u itself. Okay, so if that guy is zero, that's in some sense saying that the curve is as straight as possible. Okay, then that guy is a geodesic. Okay, so we suddenly get some preferred class of curves on the manifold, which of course will be very important in general relativity. Those will be the curves along which free particles move. So another important thing we can define once we have a connection is curvature, Riemann curvature and Ricci curvature. So in other words, you're used to the fact that partial derivatives commute. Now if I take, if I act on any function with the commutator of two partial derivatives, that's zero. Doesn't matter what order I take partial derivatives in. But that's not true of covariant derivatives. Okay. So if I take the commutator of two covariant derivatives on some vector, that will not vanish. And I define the Riemann curvature of the manifold to just be the measure of how of the degree of non-commutativity of those two derivatives. Okay? Okay, so if the two derivatives that I'm commuting are the mu derivative and the nu derivative, those are in conventional terms the final two indices of the Riemann curvature. And then the remaining two indices represent the matrix that transforms for those two commutators. This matrix represents the linear transformation between the initial v and the commutator of the derivatives acting on v. Those words only made this formula more confusing. This is a famous formula called the Ricci identity, and it is the definition. It is the way that the Riemann curvature is defined. And again, I stress to you that it had no notion of metric on the manifold yet. There's the everything we've talked about, geodesics, parallel transport, the Riemann curvature, I stress all these things already have meaning when you just have a connection on the manifold. No metric, no notion of distance. Okay. Now another thing we can do already at this point is define another important curvature tensor, the Ricci curvature, which has only two indices, and it's just obtained by summing, by contracting the upper index with one of the lower indices on the Riemann curvature. So is there anything else that I'm forgetting? I think that's all I wanted to say about step two. So now is that all I wanted to say about step two? I think so. Okay. So we have 5 minutes left. I feel I could be causing you guys to glaze over. I'm tempted, even though we only have 5 minutes left, to insert one more joke and then get 5 good minutes out of you. Instead of, what do you think? Sure, that's good enough. So the rabbit gets on the tram. He's on his way to work, and he puts down his briefcase, and he holds, you know, because he has to hold on to the handrail, and he's riding, and a few minutes later, he looks down, and his briefcase is gone. And he goes, okay, that's it? If whoever took my briefcase doesn't put it back right now, the same thing is going to happen as happened yesterday. And there's a dead silence in the car. Some people begin to cry. And the lion says, "Fine, it was a mistake, you know, here, I'm sorry. But what happened yesterday?" And the rabbit says, "Yesterday they took my briefcase and they didn't give it back." Anyway. Something very, it feels good to tell a bad joke. I don't know why. Okay, so what do we get when we add a metric? I'll just be brief here. Well, for one thing, when we add a metric, we suddenly can calculate how long a vector is. You know, so we have over some point on the manifold, up to this point, I can tell you the components of a vector, but then if I ask the basic question, how long is that vector, you couldn't answer it up until now, but if I give you the metric, then there's a natural notion of the length of a vector. Its length squared is given by g alpha beta v alpha v beta. Okay, we'll just call that v squared. And in the usual way, you can also take the inner product of two vectors. I mean, you can calculate the angle, for example, between two vectors, v and u. You know, in the usual way, you take the dot product of the two vectors divided by the length of each one, and that's the cosine of the angle between them. The metric, I mean, what is the metric? One way to say it is it's the sort of infinitesimal quadratic line element, length element on the manifold. So if I'm at this point P and I take a infinitesimal step in the dx mu direction and I want to know how far have I traveled, the metric is the thing that tells me the answer. The square of the distance that I've traveled is g mu nu contracted with dx mu dx nu, like this. And so, in particular, I now have a notion of the length of a curve from A to B. Namely, I just take infinitesimal steps along the curve, and at every step I calculate the little ds corresponding to that step, and then I integrate that ds from A to B. So the integral along gamma, or the integral from A to B along gamma of ds gives me the notion of length of the curve. Another thing that I get, that I only get once I introduce the metric, is a scalar curvature. Okay? So without the metric, I was able to define the Ricci curvature, which had four indices, the Riemann curvature, which had four indices, and the Ricci curvature, which had two indices. But now, using the metric, I can contract these remaining two indices and get a scalar, the Ricci scalar. And that's crucial for physics, because finally I have an object that I can actually, a geometrical object that I can actually take to be a term in the term in my action. And of course, this is nothing but, in general relativity, the Einstein action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, is exactly proportional to this term. Okay, so I get the Ricci curvature. What else did I want to mention? Oh yeah, so at the moment it sounds like I've introduced a connection which is arbitrary, just some arbitrary three-component field on the that I specify everywhere on the manifold, a three-index field, and some arbitrary two-index field which I specify. Really, once I have a metric, there is a preferred connection. There is a connection that is naturally, of all the possible connections, there's a connection that's naturally associated with this one. There's a unique connection which has the property that when I take the covariant derivative of g mu nu, it's zero. Okay, so in other words, there's a unique connection that is naturally associated to g because it makes g parallel to itself along any curve in any direction along the manifold. Okay? The connection that satisfies this property is called the Levi-Civita connection. or physicists usually call it the Christoffel symbol. It's given by this famous formula that you'll, is another thing that you will derive in the tutorial this afternoon. Okay, so once I have a metric, the compatible connection, the Levi-Civita connection, is determined. Once I give you the metric, you can figure out what the corresponding connection is by this formula. That's the Levi-Civita connection. And maybe the last thing to say is that you also get a new notion of geodesic. Okay, now that curves have length. Then between two points A and B on a manifold, there are special curves that have the property that their distance, well, let's first talk about the case where it's Riemannian geometry, where it's just space, not space-time, just every direction is a spatial direction. So every direction you move, the distance is always positive. In that case, the geodesics are the curves of minimum length connecting A and B. More generally, in space-time, the geodesics are the curves of extremal length. So if I, they're the special curves where if I add a little tiny little bump at any point along the curve, the length doesn't change to first order in that perturbation to the curve. Okay, and the point is that the reason I'm calling both of these things geodesics, even though this definition sounds very different than the one that I gave before, is that when the metric and the connection are related to one another in this way, when the connection is the Levi-Civita connection that is compatible with the metric, these two definitions of geodesics are the same. So the curves that are as straight as possible and parallel transport their own tangent vector u mu, that was the original definition of geodesic, those are the same as the curves that are extrema, or stationary points, those are the curves of stationary length. The curves whose length doesn't change to first order when I perturb them a little bit. And that is practically very useful because when we think of geodesics as coming from this definition, the differential equation that defines a geodesic is the one we wrote before. It's the geodesic equation written this way. That the directional derivative along u of the tangent vector to the curve vanishes. But when we reformulate geodesics as curves of stationary length, we get a much more convenient, for practical purposes, form for the geodesic equation. If I give you a metric and you want to actually calculate the geodesic equations, find the geodesics, you don't want to do it this way. You want to do it this way, which is to say you think of defining a Lagrangian, which is just 1/2 g mu nu, x dot mu, x dot nu, where x dot mu is defined to be dx mu d tau. Okay, so I imagine defining that Lagrangian. And then the Euler-Lagrange equations. Normally the Euler-Lagrange equations in classical mechanics, you have some Lagrangian, which is a function of q and q dot. And the equations of motion, can you guys see this part of the board here? So normally, the equations of motion have the form dl dq is equal to, or q dot here is equal to, dq d tau, where this is normally just the ordinary time coordinate in classical mechanics. So the Euler-Lagrange equations derived from this Lagrangian are that dL dQ is equal to ddt dL dQ dot. And so similarly, here, instead of this Lagrangian being a function of Q and Q dot, it's a function of x mu, the space-time coordinates, and x mu dot, their derivative with respect to tau. But then beyond that, everything is the same. It's the Euler-Lagrange equations, the Euler-Lagrange equations associated with this. Lagrangian. Are equivalent to this version of the geodesic equation. These two versions of the geodesic equation are equivalent, but this one is in practice much easier to calculate and work with. The point is that in the same way that fundamentally this Euler-Lagrange equation comes from extremizing, comes from the variational principle extremizing the action that you do in classical mechanics. These Euler-Lagrange equations come from the variational principle extremizing the length of the curve, which we're doing again because of this result, that these two different definitions of the geodesics, one being straightness and one being stationarity of length, are equivalent to one another. Okay, so that was my extremely condensed review of differential geometry. I apologize, I ran 5 minutes over. That wasn't part of the deal. I know. I said I was going to tell a joke and then I'll go for 5 more minutes, and I forgot. And in the future, some you guys can speak up and stop me if I lose track of time like that. But anyway, sorry about that. I'll try not to do that. But So hopefully by the middle of next class, we will have done a similarly lightning review of GR, and then we'll be on our way. The background review will be over, and we'll be ready to embark upon the great voyage into the universe. Okay.